Welcome to this Tuesday, July 23rd edition of our roundtable panel. I'm Joe Donahue. It's a thrill to have you with us. We obviously, as we always do, invite you to join us. All you have to do is go to roundtable@wamc.org, roundtable@wamc.org. We have a wonderful panel this morning. We, of course, have WAMC's Alan Chartok, WAMC's Ray Graff, and also Albany Common Council member, resident of Arbor Hill, author, feminist scholar, and community activist Barbara Smith with us. Good morning, Barbara. How
are
you?
Good morning, Joe. How are you?
It's a thrill to have you here. Later in the hour, Jimmy Vielkind of the Times Union and their Capitol reporter will join us. It's a thrill to have you here. We're going to continue to talk about the issue of race brought up by the president's comments on Friday. We also want to talk about there was an interesting new poll in the Washington Post this morning. The not guilty verdict in the trial of George Zimmerman has produced dramatically different reactions among blacks and whites, with African Americans overwhelmingly disapproving of the jury's decision, with a bare majority of whites saying they approve of the outcome. The jury's decision in the case that involved the killing of black teenager Trayvon Martin continues to roil the country with protests, demonstrations, calls for federal intervention, and a nonstop debate about how the degree to which race played a role in the shooting and in the trial. When it comes to that nonstop debate, Barbara, I mean, obviously, I assume you see this as a lawmaker in Albany. You see this on the front lines.
Are you talking about, are there incidents here that are similar?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, in the overall problems.
Right.
I mean, the problem when we talk about African-American males, when we talk about violence, when we talk about race, when we talk about profiling, these are all issues that we deal with as a city.
Absolutely. And I hear that as chair of our public safety committee. I have a lot of involvement with both the police and the fire department. And I also try to attend as often as I can the Citizens Police Review Board that the city has. And that's where the complaints and the dynamics definitely come up.
Will it always be a debate, do you think?
Well, what I like about this particular historical period and this particular racial context and response to the trial of George Zimmerman is that we're talking about some things that I don't believe we've ever addressed as clearly and comprehensively before. We haven't gotten to the comprehensive part, but what I hear a lot in these days since the verdict was delivered is that people are listening to African Americans talk about what happens with their children and the kinds of messages they have to deliver and the kinds of new messages they might have to deliver in the wake of this verdict. So what we have now is actually black people who have experienced being black for however many years they are on earth saying what it's like to be a black person. And it's not just singular. It's lots of black people are having that opportunity.
So when you have the president of the United States make very personal remarks on Friday, I mean, it seems to me, just on the face of it, that can only help that conversation and help grease the wheels and allow it to go on. As time goes on, since Friday when he made the remarks, he is now more and more criticism, oddly enough, is mounting about either in two camps, one that it was too little too late or that he's fanning the flames. And I'm curious as to what you think of that.
Well, I think that President Obama as the first African-American president is absolutely in a very challenging position because it's almost like whatever he does, there's going to be critique. And the two elements that you're talking about, the two parts of our citizenry that you're talking about, people who think it's not enough, probably to the left of the president, and I'm sure that would include lots of people, are lots of people of color, although not all, and then people on the right side of the spectrum would wish that all of this would go away. So there's a right-wing theory now that we're living in a colorblind society, and when incidents like this happen, that just goes right out the window. So it's just really, really difficult, as I said, for the person who embodies that as our first African-American president to address it and have everybody be happy.
The question, it seems to me, Joe, is at what point, and Barbara, the question seems to me, at what point are white folks going to be able to put themselves inside a black skin? I don't know how to say it better than that, but that's really what it is all about. Because if it was your son, if it was somebody just on the basis of the stupidity of difference being defined by skin pigment, that's all it is. How can we put ourselves inside, if I'm white, inside the... Well, I do it very easily. I remember back to the stories of Nazi Germany and what was happening to Jews as when they were the gold stars and they were picked out as the people who do this. I think that this thing that the president did, I still have a sneaking suspicion that the first lady had a great deal to do with this. Said, you get down there right now, you know, and do
that's
this.
That's an interesting scenario.
Yeah, right. Because all of a sudden, at a place where the president doesn't usually show up at the press briefing, which is done, there he is, and he does it. And, you know, if in your presidency, you're going to make one big difference to the people who are depending on you, this is the day and the time to do it. And he goes down there. And I thought, frankly, he was magnificent. He spoke from the heart. He laid it all out. And I think people scratched their heads and said, I hear this. It could have been me, a number of years ago, he said. And that's right. And here we're talking about the president of the United States. So, I mean, sure, there'll always be criticism, and there probably should in a democracy. He didn't go far enough, sure. Well, you know, we know that since the Civil War, we have had Reconstruction, there has been an unending effort to put black people down. We know that. I mean, it just hasn't changed. So that's all I got to say about that.
You start off by saying that was going to be a question. I didn't.
Yeah, you know.
Well, that happens a lot.
So what happens when you got a bad back?
So I find it interesting because one of the criticisms that seems to be coming out, and I don't think this is I don't know that I shouldn't define it as a criticism, but it's a point that while the president certainly talked about some of the things that need to be done, there have been some in the op-ed pages who have suggested it shows that there wasn't a lot of thinking beforehand of an infrastructure in place to actually address these issues.
There has never been an infrastructure like that in a widespread way, and certainly not coming from the federal government, to discuss these issues. One of the things that I often say when I'm talking about issues of race, often in the context of delivering a talk at a campus or something like that, I'll ask them, I said, where in this society could you find out accurate information about issues of race? And the answer is nowhere. The closest we have are on those college and university campuses where you have black studies, Latino studies, women's studies, all different kinds of disciplines that didn't exist when I was in college. I assume that would apply to you, Alan. But the thing is,
I'm older than you are.
So we didn't have that kind of subject matter when we went to college. But the thing is, it now exists, and there are actual sites in this country where those dialogues are happening. But they're very limited because they're on really great college and university campuses. They're not in the community. They're not down the block.
So what do we do? I mean, how do we improve? How do we begin to build that infrastructure? And for God's sakes, you know, if not now, when? And why shouldn't building blocks have been put in place?
Well, actually, I'm thinking of another place in our society where the dialogues are happening. And that's where people are actually working to rectify the injustices that exist. So there are some people right here in the United States, whatever their age, people who are older than we are, who have always been involved in that dialogue because it's that important to them to live in a just society. So they are in regular contact with people who are different from themselves. They embrace diversity in their lives, and they have these conversations. I dare say that there are people in my friendship circle here in Albany, people who are not people of color, who already knew that black parents and parents of color have to have that conversation with their children. Do you see what I'm saying?
So
there are a couple of places, but again, it's not widespread, and it certainly isn't mandated by any big, powerful entity.
I was fascinated, Joe, very quickly in one of the tabs this morning to see that the resurrection of Zimmerman is beginning. He helped pull somebody out of a bus, a car that overturned. And, you know, all of a sudden, in this particular tab, he's becoming, you know, this hero who did this. You know, I think that there's a distinction, Joe, in terms of what you just said. I think that people understand that a jury trial was one thing. And I think the president was very careful on that one. But the racism that surrounds the whole issue, what happens with stop and frisk and all the other things, that's the issue that is before us now.
Yes, and the question is, why was George Zimmerman so highly motivated to follow a young, relatively young teenager
sure.
who he did not know, who wasn't doing anything?
Sure.
Why did he feel the need to do that? Now, there had been break-ins, as I understand, in that gated community. So that might have made him, since he was self-anointed neighborhood watch, might have made him.
But if the guy was black, was white, it wouldn't have happened.
No, because white people are not automatic suspects. That's another part of the dialogue that's coming out now. I think I heard last night on television, they said that one out of four black men in the last month have been stopped by police. That is in the country, one out of four. That's a huge number of
that's
people.
That's 25%.
Yes.
I mean, that's insane. So when the president touched on this in his remarks about specifically African-American young males.
Right.
And that of targeting that population of having so much negativity around that population and trying to come up again with an infrastructure to have positive role models and to work with that population at a very crucial time to improve their culture and to improve their future. That seems, when we talk about white teens, that we have that down. So why is it so difficult when we talk about African-American teens?
Because African-American teenagers in general are across the board are growing up in a context where racism exists. And then a lot of African-American teenagers are also growing up in poverty. So with those factors mm-hmm. combined, it means that you're living in a community that doesn't necessarily have the resources, the beautiful swimming pool, the playing fields, you know, all the kinds of things, the cultural opportunities, et cetera, et cetera.
Or even the pre-K programs.
Say that again?
Even the pre-K programs.
Right.
Or, you know, forget about all the other things. But that's long run. The question is, and it seems to me, Barbara, what about short run? What do you do when you find an African-American teenager who has committed a crime? What happens then? What do you do? I mean, the long-run solution is you treat everybody equally, you get equality of opportunity. But there's a short-run thing, and then there's a long-run thing. What do you do?
Well, there's been a movement in New York State recently around juvenile offenders and the systems to deal with them is to try to keep them as much as possible within the community instead of meting out harsh punishment and warehousing them in some cases, intolerable
sure.
conditions where their disconnection and alienation from society only grows. The desire is, and the new policy, and as I said, this is going on in New York State, is to have them be a part of the community even while rehabilitation and other kinds of opportunities are going on. It works in St. Louis. It works. That's one of the places that model is being used. But warehousing, throwing away, considering some kids that they're automatic failures based upon their race or their class status, that's not going to help us at all. It's in a long, long history. We're talking about centuries of
Indeed.
Inequality and centuries of oppression. We're not going to snap our fingers and have it end in a few weeks or even a few months. But as I said, I really feel that what's being discussed in many places in the society right now in the wake of that trial, I think it's incredibly healthy. And I think we are speaking on a different level because when you see news anchors on major networks saying this is what I had to do when I went home. After being in front of you on the news all over the nation, I had to go home and talk to my teenagers about what happened to make sure that they do not feel so afraid and so unstable in their sense of security that they can continue to function and flourish. At the very same time, I need to tell them this is what you need to do when you encounter somebody who might indeed be a danger to you. News anchors are saying that. The president said it.
Albany Common Council member Barbara Smith joins us this morning on our panel. We're going to take a short break. We always welcome your input. Roundtable at WAMC.org. We'll continue the conversation after this short break.
Support for WAMC comes from the Tang Teaching Museum and Art Gallery at Skidmore College, providing exhibits, public events, and educational programs for audiences of all ages for the Capital District and beyond. 518-580-8080. Capital Region Honda dealers with locations in New York, Vermont, and Massachusetts offering new and pre-owned Hondas, capitalregionhondadealers.com. Tannery Pond Concerts, New Lebanon, New York, presenting Miro String Quartet, Saturday, July 27th, 8 p.m. in the Tannery, 888-820-1696. And Saugerties Furniture, Saugerties, family-owned for 65 years with four floors of American-made furniture and mattresses. Open daily, delivery throughout the Hudson Valley, SaugertiesFurniture.com.
Welcome back to our roundtable panel. Alan Chartok is here, Ray Graff, and Barbara Smith joins us, Albany Common Council member, resident of Arbor Hill as well. You know, when it comes to your job as a Common Council member, and obviously given the area that you serve, so what can you do? What do you think can be done in your community? What resources can you use to help address and improve the situation? As you say, it can't happen overnight, but to at least start the process.
One thing to know is that there are people in Albany who have been working on the issue of black male youth, concentrating on it with a laser-like focus and being incredibly effective and incredibly committed, usually without any kind of infrastructure or pay or whatever, just people who look at the situation, generally older black men, and they look at the situation, they say, I need to give back and I'm going to be involved. I could name half a dozen black men like that in Albany who are doing that work, and some are doing it in an organizational context. So that's happening. But for me, during these almost 8 years that I've been on the Common Council, two of my highest priorities have been to do something in relationship to violence in our inner city communities, and we now have snug ceasefire and have had that since 2010 in Albany. And it has made a big difference because snug is a public health model, and it's about changing the culture that accepts violence as inevitable. The other thing, of course, that I've been working on, and it's no surprise given that I am a professional educator myself, is improving educational opportunity for children and young people in our neighborhoods. We do that through our Albany Family Education Alliance, which is a grassroots organization, and we also are doing that via Albany Promise, which is a coalition of people from all sectors, including the corporate sector, the universities, et cetera, to try to look at the problem in a data-driven way and begin to make changes in how we deliver education.
Now, this radio station goes to parts of six states. And so there are people who are listening to what we're talking about right now in Springfield, for example, or in Lowell, or in, you know, any of the towns that have similar problems. So how unique is what happens here in Albany to what happens in all inner cities?
It's not unique at all.
Yeah.
We have general and recognizable dynamics bred by centuries of discrimination, racism, and disproportionate poverty. So the violence that we see in Chicago or the violence that we see in Cleveland or Los Angeles, that's, you know, Albany's not that size of a city. We're not that huge. But the thing is, any urbanized area in the United States generally has issues around disenfranchisement of people of color generally, issues around black youth, particularly what are black males doing with their time and, you know, what avenues do they have for success, and certainly other all those other issues. Yes, there's a lot to be learned from those other places, too.
Barbara, in the break, I asked you about Emmett Till, because a lot of people have been invoking Emmett Till as a result of this trial. A great martyr in terms of African-American history in the United States. And now Trayvon Martin. Do you see any parallels?
There's absolutely a parallel. They were minors. I think Emmett Till was 14 when he was brutalized and killed. And that was that 1955? And Trayvon had just turned 17. He was only a few days past his 17th birthday. So, yes, there's a lot in common. And it's about staying in your place. They didn't, somehow, Trayvon Martin managed not to stay in his place, even though he was going back home to where his father and his father's fiance lived. So Emmett Till, that context was, he was from Chicago. Emmett Till was from Chicago. He didn't know about Jim Crow, or at least he didn't know about it sufficiently to know that if he saw a woman who was white and he had some kind of interaction with her that implied that they were equals, that he would pay the ultimate price. But yes, absolutely, there are parallels.
So
and the hurt and the pain within our communities and those who are in alliance with our communities is deep and similar.
So how important is this concept of martyrdom?
I don't like martyrdom. I don't like martyrdom at all, because I've lived through all of the major martyrs of the 20th century from midpoint on. I even, growing up in Cleveland, there was a white minister who was involved in our civil rights movement. They were building some new schools that would be segregated because of residential segregation. He was at a demonstration, which was a construction site. He lay down in a ditch or in front of a steam shovel. The steam shovel rolled over him and killed him. So I grew up with a martyr. You know, he was a white, young white man, a minister, as I said. And then there were all the others. So martyrdom to me, like one of the things that we used to say when I was involved in our black feminist organizing, is that we want live revolutionaries, not dead martyrs.
So how many live revolutionaries do we have out there right now?
We have quite a few. There are demonstrations going on all over this country. I think it's really heartening. Those of us who take courage from and inspiration from those who speak out and do something. We see people at the Florida State House, the Capitol, they're sitting in, despite the fact that the governor said, no, we're not going to reexamine the Stand Your Ground law. They're still there, and they have been there for days.
Hardly Faubus. The governor, the change in the tone, you know, it's a respectful tone from the governor, even though he's dead wrong. It is not what you saw in the old Southern style.
No, it's different. No, it's slick. It's very slick.
Yeah.
But it still puts you in the same position. I mean, the voter suppression that's going on in this country, the Supreme Court decision that erased, Article 5 of the Voting Rights Act, it's just stunning. But people are speaking up. In North Carolina, they have had Moral Mondays for the last 12 weeks, if I understand it. Hundreds of people in North Carolina have been arrested around an array of issues, not just racial issues, but also around reproductive freedom, around voter suppression, around poverty. All those things are being addressed, and people are going to jail just like they did in the 1960s to stand up for what's right.
Yeah, well, you know, there was cities burned. M.L. King, the Rodney King brutalization. We're not seeing that now. Is that progress?
The painting of the black community and the brown community as prone to violence and likely to go off at the drop of a hat, as has been pointed out during these couple of weeks of dialogue, most of the race riots in this country were led and started by white people. They were, because when you burn down a Tulsa community, a black community, when you burn down Rosewood, Florida, when you pillage and, you know, kill people during the draft riots, during the Civil War in New York City, those were led by white people. And if you look at history, you will find that Where there have been significant black populations, there generally were race riots that were racially motivated and led by white people. But I think we're in a different historical era. So who knows why we're not having major confrontations in our city streets. One of the things is that Trayvon Martin's mother and father have provided incredible leadership and have basically said, we don't want to see this. We want to do this peacefully. We're in it for the long haul. We want to prevent anything happening to your child that has already happened to ours. They're phenomenal leaders who just stepped up and have made something incredibly positive out of the most horrific tragedy in their lives. So with those instructions from Sabrina Fulton, that's the way it is. She told people, I don't want to see that craziness. And I think people out of respect have made decisions. We know we can have our voices heard in other ways.
Barbara Smith is an Albany Common Council member, resident of Arbor Hill, author, feminist scholar, and community activist. It is a great pleasure to have you join us this morning. I thank you very much. I hope you'll come back.
Thank you, Joel. Yes, just
welcome
down the street. I'm very
happy. Excellent.
To come
on back. We'll talk about other stuff. Barbara, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Coming up next, Times Union, it's Jimmy Vilkind will join us to talk about political stories and a little Capital Confidential, that and more, coming up in just a moment on WAMC.
Support for WAMC comes from Mark Lawson Antiques, Saratoga Springs, and Colony, New York. Purchasing estate jewelry, coins, silver, fine arts, and collections, sponsor of Antiques Roadshow, marklawson.com. Alacrity Frame Workshop, Albany, New York, offering custom framing and local art in the Capital Region, open every day except Tuesdays, alacrityframeworkshop.com. United Way of the Greater Capital Region, Albany, New York, investing in education, financial stability, and health, unitedwaygcr.org. And Utica College, offering a Master of Science degree in Cybersecurity Intelligence and Forensics online, utica.edu.
Hi, this is Pat in Operations. Keep in mind, if you're driving through the listening area, you can tune us in at these other translators: Lake Placid 88.7, Beacon 103.9, Ellenville 96.5, Highland 102.1, Hudson 97.1, Middletown 106.3, Milford PA 90.9 FM, Newburgh 107.7, Oneonta 99.3 and 90.1, Rensselaer Troy Manans 93.1, Warwick 107.1, and in Cooperstown at 97.3.
Support for WAMC comes from Lake George Kayak Company, a kayak, canoe, and stand-up paddleboard center providing sales, rent, and lessons, lakegeorgekayak.com. Watercolors by Edith, Shutesbury, Massachusetts. Edith Hunsberger, a painter in acrylic and watercolors, specializing in portrait paintings of people and pets from photographs. Edith-Hunsberger.artistwebsites.com. Ashfield Stone, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts. Quarry and fabrication, used for enduring landscapes and interiors, including countertops and floor planking. Rare and wonderful native stone of the Berkshires, ashfieldstone.com. And Proctor's, presenting the Cirque Elwaz Circopolis, August 7th through 24th, proctors.org.
Welcome back to our roundtable panel for this Tuesday, the 23rd of July. Ray Graff is here, WAMC's Alan Shartok, and our good friend, Times Union Capital reporter Jimmy Vilkind joins us now. Good morning, Jimmy.
Good morning, Joe.
It's great to have you back. Thank you very much. You came down from the mountains.
Yeah, I'm dried off now, but I was up on Sunday with Governor Cuomo, who led a whitewater rafting competition down the Indian River up in Indian Lake in Hamilton County. And the governor, it was sort of an interesting idea he had. He called it the Adirondack Challenge. It was essentially a two-day festival in and around Indian Lake, which featured some community events, some semi-professional canoe races, and then this whitewater rafting competition in which the governor raced legislative leaders, political figures from around the state. And on Monday, day two, he raced New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Surprise, surprise, at the Cuomo-controlled event, the governor was pronounced the winner of each day's races.
That ain't right.
Are you suggesting the fix was in?
All I know is that when you play pin the tail on the donkey at your own birthday party, the birthday boy or girl is not supposed to win. Right? I mean, that's just
not considered right.
Just how I was raised.
So what comes out of this?
Well, you know, that's kind of the interesting question. And there's some degree of eye rolling about the whole thing, which was a lot of fun. And I have to say it was a lot of fun. And the experience of rafting down the river was a lot of fun. Any listener who has the inclination should go check it out. But that was kind of the point of what the governor was doing. He wanted to draw attention to tourism opportunities in and around Indian Lake. He wanted to draw attention to the great natural assets of the Adirondack Park. And his argument is that we get 50 million people each year who come through New York City, tourists from around the country and around the world. And as he says, if even a small fraction of them go up to the Adirondack Park or spend the extra few days to go north and see the world-class natural assets that New York State has to offer, that will translate into lots of dollars for the region, which will hopefully help rebuild an economic base or help further develop tourism as other economic bases in that region erode.
And we've put a lot of money into the Adirondacks. I mean, it's bigger than some states.
Right. Well, it's 6 million acres public park, bigger than most of the national parks. And, you know, a lot of people don't know about it. So you could criticize this event, say, oh, this is just a gigantic gubernatorial ego trip.
How much did it cost?
They say $175,000 of state funds. Uh-huh. But they say that the publicity it generated was priceless. You know, CBS This Morning, a nationally televised morning show, did a segment about this. NPR aired a segment on this morning's morning edition segments. You saw the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, several niche magazines. I ran into a Taiwanese television crew up there. So I look forward to reviewing
were
that
Were they
segment.
Racing as well?
They did. They were racing, and they were in my raft. And
cool.
Yeah.
How many were in a raft?
It was about 6 people per raft. You had to paddle through. It was class 3 rapids, about 3 miles down the Indian River. No one fell in with the exception of Larry Schwartz, who is Governor Cuomo's top aide, his secretary.
Did Cuomo push him in?
You know, there are a lot of unanswered questions about what happened. You know, well, you the governor's the daughters were also present.
I see.
Larry is okay, though.
Okay. Where was the security detail?
There was one trooper with the governor, and you know, okay. I question. You know, here you've got a fit to do whatever state trooper. You know, really pounding through and paddling. So you know, you could make a lot of arguments about the fairness of this event. But,
He comes by that very naturally because, as you may remember, Papa used to like to play basketball, and quite frequently there were some guys from the troopers who were involved on his team.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, the governor, the current governor, Cuomo 56, not Cuomo 54, he's really pushing for, he's trying to burnish this outdoorsy image, right? You remember in September of last year, he led an excursion to the Boreas Ponds region and he went fishing and there were pictures of him fishing and he was in a canoe. As someone who was in the canoe next to him, I can say that he is not the world's most experienced canoeist. But, you know, here's a guy who may perhaps kind of someday think about possibly trying for a federal level job.
No.
Maybe like dog catcher available, I think, in 2016. But so as he thinks about maybe possibly thinking about this someday, this sort of outdoorsy middle America, I'm human, here I am with my daughters kind of photos and image presented to the world could be helpful. And so I think that there's some self.
You guys are so
self better. I know, Alan. I'm just a cynical man. cynical man.
So let's talk a little bit about you have a great thing in on Capital Confidential about political theater. As you mentioned, Jan Crawford of CBS went up on the rafting trip to interview the governor for what was to be his second nationally televised interview in a matter of,
I believe, the year. He doesn't do them very often. He did a few around Superstorm Sandy in the fall.
Yeah.
But there are some political figures who are sort of fixtures on the Sunday morning talk shows or could get their faces on the evening news whenever they want. And Andrew Cuomo is no doubt in that class of political figure. But he eschews the national attention. He says it'll just fuel speculation about the dog catcher run in 2016. And he's avoided it. But twice in a month now, he's done this national interview. And sort of the flip side, again, he wanted to promote the Adirondacks. And CBS aired, a 4-minute segment in which they featured beautiful footage of the Adirondacks. But then they asked him about, well, what do you think of this Elliot Spitzer guy running for comptroller? What do you think of, Anthony Weiner? And so Cuomo said, oh, it's political theater. Oh, it's something I have to distance myself from.
It's part of the charm of New York.
Yeah, part of the charm of New York. But I think that it actually makes him I've written and talked about how the candidacies of Elliot Spitzer and Anthony Weiner are bad for Cuomo because key to his narrative is this idea that he has tamed or at least tamped down the circus that is New York politics. And if Elliot Spitzer or Anthony Weiner are successful within the arena of New York politics, certainly they've already shown that they've gained traction within the arena of New York politics. But if they are successful, it's going to create a real headache for Andrew Cuomo. But it'll create an almost literary headache in that, well, he'll be lumped in with what some people who are not perhaps astute observers or who don't see the assets of Anthony Weiner or Elliot Spitzer as readily as some others do might consider to be a circus.
Well, it's interesting because, we all know that Andrew Cuomo had his difficulties earlier in life. There were accusations of, sexual infidelity and all the rest of it at the time. But he got a pass. He really did get a pass. I mean, at the time, it blew up in his face, but time has healed that wound. And I suspect what you may be hinting at or saying specifically here is he doesn't need this reminding people of that.
Well, perhaps. I think it's, again, I don't see it unnecessarily that sort of level of sexual peccadilloes. I see it as, his narrative is making government function and making government almost boring and helpful, right? In New York, if you really boil down our political scene from the Spitzer resignation through the election of Cuomo, there were scandal, problem, they fought, they bickered, and nothing got done, right? How many times did I have to write that story? How many times did you broadcast some version of that story? Whereas the basic story needs to be, and Governor Cuomo, especially during his first 2 years in office, was very successful at, they did something. They accomplished. The budget got done on time. We passed the bill. We did this. We did. And now in this the third year of the governor's administration, there's something of a fragile point as he faces a more recalcitrant legislature where major components of his agenda as laid out earlier this year were not enacted during the legislative session. Where he really needs to guard that and needs to guard it quite closely. So I think that that certainly weighs on his mind. And I also think that it's summertime. It was fun. It could help the Adirondacks, and it could also help humanize him a little bit. Why not?
Well,
seems like a good idea.
The dark music in the background, there are pieces in the paper this morning about about Chris Christie and doing better and Hillary doing a little worse in Iowa, I believe this last poll was, but showing Joe Biden doing better than Hillary.
Right.
And I'm fascinated by that because you never know how all this stuff is going to end up.
Well, right. And, of course, Joe Biden has strengths and weaknesses, but his big strength is that kind of every man Bud Light appeal, you know? And so that is arguably not Andrew Cuomo's strength and his appeal as a political figure. So perhaps that was playing in the background.
So it's interesting if Hillary doesn't run, then I think we could expect that there might be somewhat of a contest between Joe Biden and Andrew.
I think that that's certainly possible. We should remind people that it is 2013. The dog catcher race is in 2016.
Yes.
I'm not a mathematician, but I think that is 3 years away, 2.5 really, halfway through 2013. So the early polls they don't indicate too much. They indicate essentially name ID.
I don't think I agree with you.
Okay.
I mean, I think if the graph is what the ray graph that you might want to see, sort of going down. It was a bad pun. I'm sorry about that.
I have no idea what you're going
to
do.
No, what I'm saying is, Jimmy's saying it's 2016. Why don't you shut up and wait till things develop? But, you know, as a political scientist, I'm interested in the way in which we graph this thing. In other words, with Hillary's popularity, is it going down? Is it sustainable? Because we've seen a lot of people as the front runners who don't end up as the winners.
Yeah, but I mean, look at the Republican race last time.
Yeah.
Every week there was a new leader.
Yeah.
And that was during the actual, you know,
the boil down period of like 2 years
or something.
Fascinated.
Yeah. I'm fascinated by that because sometimes that kind of change indicates that you don't have good candidates running in the total field. Look at the mayoralty in New York right now. I think people are not happy with the field.
You write in the Capital Confidential posting that Jan Crawford closed her segment by saying Cuomo, quote unquote, dispelled any rumors that he was interested in a 2016 presidential bid.
Right. So everything we've been saying is just hypothetical that he might someday, perhaps, maybe begin to think about the dog catcher.
Oh, please.
The dog catcher position.
Yeah.
Right.
And ultimately. When it all comes down to it, now that your clothes are dry and you're back, then what happens next in Albany?
Well, the summertime in Albany is always interesting because there's no natural thing to watch. The legislature has left town. Still outstanding is the issue of the women's equality agenda, which we've talked about before. Just as a quick refresher, this was a 10-point agenda put forward by the governor. And its most controversial provision would have codified the provisions of Roe v. Wade in New York's abortion law and made changes to New York's abortion law. And that was anathema to many Republicans, including those who control in coalition with this independent Democratic faction, the Republicans in the state Senate. So the state Senate broke it into 10 pieces and passed 9 of them, not the abortion stuff. The state assembly, led by Democrats and their speaker, Sheldon Silver from Manhattan, passed the omnibus version of the bill. And in Albany, we don't reconcile things legislatively the way the federal Congress does. So that means that nothing has been done. And the big question on everyone's lips is the state assembly going to return? Will they take up these 9 separate bills? Should they take up these 9 separate bills? Should they maintain their position and try to force a vote in the Senate? And, you know, we're still in the bickering mode. And since legislators have left town, the question's actually not very pressing. Now, there was this possibility that there would be an extraordinary session, a special session of the legislature, prompted by the need to appropriate funds for flood recovery in the Mohawk Valley. That has now come and gone. The governor last week announced a $16 million state appropriation to help individuals affected in Oneida, Herkimer, Niagara County by this flooding.
Right.
So no special session of the legislature. I reported in this morning's editions that the lobbying disclosures for both the supporters and the opponents of the women's equality agenda, or I should say the opponents of the abortion plank in the women's equality agenda, came through and spent about $500,000 on ads, which is interesting as we look at the general course of political spending at the Capitol.
And $151 on candy.
$151 on candy. It was an interesting idea. They gave out payday bars to legislators during one lobbying visit. So $151. And for those who don't know, including me until I Googled it yesterday, a payday bar has no chocolate.
You never had a payday bar?
You know, my paydays are so few and far between, Ray.
Okay, I'll bite.
That's all we get around here, as a matter of fact. Every 2 weeks, here's your payday bar.
So if they don't have chocolate, what do they have?
It's caramel surrounded by salted peanuts.
Yeah, it's delicious. And nutritious, I might add.
Yeah, the base of it is, it's kind of a mess, but like a roll of, you take the caramel and then just roll it in peanuts, right?
Yeah.
And I feel like now we finally hit our stride.
And then ossify it.
And
yes.
Why are they called payday?
No idea.
Payday is the punch of getting peanuts and caramel in one bite.
sort of like a Hawaiian punch.
Hershey's there is going to be sending Joe a check for that.
There you go. Promo. Is that who makes them, Hershey's? Okay, I don't know.
I think we've covered this fully now.
Yeah. All right.
Well, the other interesting news was actually something that my colleague Brendan Lyons reported in our Sunday and Monday editions. He obtained an old file that previous Attorney General, Andrew Cuomo, when he was Attorney General, had compiled, looking at the nexus between politicians and the state police. Some listeners may recall that during the Patterson administration, I believe in 2010, Cuomo issued his report about the state police and about political interference. And it found that there was political interference in the workings of the state police. There was no rogue unit, quote unquote, as some had suspected and thought. My colleague Brendan was able to review essentially the material that was left on the cutting room floor from that investigation. It was now available under the Freedom of Information Law and made available to the Times Union by the current Attorney General, Eric Schneiderman. So there's some interesting nuggets in there. There was the nugget that Elliot Spitzer didn't like the troopers to be near his hotel rooms at night. I can't imagine why.
By the way, that's de rigueur. I mean, JFK, who was known for his amorous interludes while married, did, I think, the same thing. I think there was some cooperation, in fact.
Yes, it was a different day, and I think that they struck different public personas on the issue.
I had the idea reading the article in the Times Union. It was sort of, you know, here, guys, here's $20. Go down to the arcade, and I'll see you in an hour.
Well, yeah, and you could
go play Galaga for state troopers play Galaga. That's nice.
That was probably the sexiest, if I can make a pun, tidbit. Yeah. Another interesting one was that Congressman Greg Meeks was apparently driving over 100 miles an hour up the thruway on his way to dinner with then-Governor Patterson. He was accosted by troopers but never ticketed or charged with anything. Apparently he was using official flashing lights as he was doing this. So that was interesting.
He was using flashing lights?
That was what the materials in the Attorney General's report suggested.
Well, good for them for pulling him over. I wouldn't even think.
Well,
yeah. You sort of look and go, oh, maybe it's somebody else I'm not aware of.
They might have suspected that something was up. They can run a license plate.
Oh, that's true.
Just as well as the next guy. And interesting revelation about former Congressman John Sweeney, who people may recall state troopers were summoned to his home in Clifton Park for a dispute with his former wife. And there was a great deal of back and forth over how the report was entered into the state police system and whether the words domestic dispute or domestic incident were involved in the report. And this investigation by the Attorney General's office found that it was indeed sanitized, that former Superintendent Wayne Bennett, now the Public Safety Commissioner in Schenectady, played a role, and that another Sweeney confidant also played a role. So lots of interesting little nuggets that that Brendan Lyons unearthed, and certainly worth a read if you get a chance.
All of this at timesunion.com. Timesunion.com. Jimmy Vielkind is the Times Union Capital reporter and posts regularly, of course, to Capital Confidential. Jimmy, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Joe.
We welcome your input. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Alan Raymond, thank you very much.
Okay.
We'll wake you for the news at 11.
Oh, cut it out.
All right. You'll be back for that, right?
Yeah, maybe.
All right. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.